Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And we need to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our call. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because, of course, we have, well, we're going to have a special guest, Michael Trudeau, this evening. And, of course, he worked for many years at Genesis, where I initially met him, and now he's with Colonial Resources. But we're going to be talking about what's happening financially in the world today. And, you know, we have a fiat money system. And, of course, you only need to go back and see what Alan Greenspan had written many, many years ago about the fiat money system. He recognized, of course, that the monetary system has something solidly behind it, or it would eventually become worthless. In fact, if you go to the Encyclopedia Americana, and I have this as a source of reference, it talks really about the background of a fiat money system and points out that fiat money eventually always becomes worthless. Well, right now, of course, everybody in the world, all the monetary systems are based upon a fiat money system. And, of course, you right now, why we're running massive deficits with communist China. And it is communist China. They don't refer to it as communist China today, because they don't want you to, they want you to believe communism is dead, but it's not. It's alive and well all throughout the world today, and universities are teaching communism. Many of our schools are teaching the Marxist philosophy of a total dependence upon government. But communist China holds something between, I think, maybe $700 billion in American currency. In other words, that's the reserves. But now they want to get rid of it. Of course, they've gotten up to Canada. They bought up the oil shale there. They're building a massive pipeline from the oil shale of Alberta over to the coast, Pacific Ocean, so that they can begin getting that oil. Past we would have gotten. They're investing heavily in Venezuela. The Chinese communists are investing their American dollars throughout the world. As you know, they bought up IBM PC, and now they put in a bid for Unocal, Union Oil of California, one of the largest oil companies we have in the United States, $18.5 billion. And of course, Chevron had offered something like $16.5 billion for it. But the Chinese, $18.5 billion, and they're legitimate dollars. They of course, earned it in free trade. Now, I don't want to see the Chinese communists owning Unocal, but what does it mean if they have all these dollars and we say, well, you can't spend them, you can't buy them. We'll buy your products, but you can't buy any of our major corporations. What are they going to do with those dollars? Well, I think that they can't buy Unocal. Why, the Chinese communists are going to start dumping their dollars so fast it'll make your head spin. The whole world monetary system is based upon a fiat money system, and there's no incidents in all history where a fiat money system has survived. And people who are not making preparations now to protect themselves will probably lose everything they have. And with that as a background, Michael Trudeau, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, Stan. I'll tell you, you bring up that very valid point that if people aren't, you know, making some forms of protection at this point, that, you know, things will be very perilous for them. And it's a matter of the difference between survival and basically not respect of what you know to be your day-to-day life. Obviously, if things get really dramatically changed in all kinds of ways that we could never predict or foresee, so there's a lot of things we really can't necessarily protect for, but it makes prudent sense to always be protected.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Michael Trudeau talking about what's really happening in the world financially that you're not going to regular channels. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Michael Trudeau from Colonial Resources. And Michael, to go ahead and pick up this story right there. People need to begin protecting themselves, but most people don't even know there's a problem.
Well, you know, I think that in respect that a lot of people now are finally kind of coming to the conclusion that things are getting bad, and I think it just comes down to that decline on the dollar really having an effect on just about everybody. I mean, it's really almost impossible for you now to, you know, pull your money out of your pocket, purchase something, and not feel the effect of the fact that the dollar breakneck pace roughly on an average of about, you know, 12% annually. And I mean, this is the thing that, again, points immediately to why people are kind of rushing into precious metals right now, because it's always been known as the safe haven against inflation. And one thing I want to talk about tonight is that we already pretty much know that the fundamentals are in place that strongly favor gold ownership. Gold has increased 70% in the last 5 years, while we've mentioned the dollar has declined at an annual pace that averages about 12% a year over the last 3 years. So unless you've invested in gold, it's hard to imagine that your annuities, CDs, bonds, or stocks are keeping pace with this 12% dollar's decline. If you start to take a look at what's happening out there in the world, it really doesn't look like many people are stacking the deck in our favor as citizens. Thursday Supreme Court basically put your house up for sale, basically to just the highest bidder. They're telling us that eminent domain can now be bought and sold to the condo developer or the person who wants to put up a mall in your neighborhood and simply promises to bring more tax revenue to your municipality. So now your municipality, according to Supreme Court, home, and give it to the shopping mall or condo.
I think what's so important about that decision, Michael, is the fact that in the past, why the developer would have to come to you. You've got a good position. You're on a main street. He wants to put a development there, and he would have to negotiate with you and pay what he wanted for your home. No longer is that necessary. What he does is go to the local politician, and by one means or another, give them some sort of a special favor. You know, buy a little some gift for them, promise them a good job for their son-in-law, and this is how the system worked. In fact, I heard Arnold Schwarzenegger just last Friday on the Jay Leno program when this subject was brought up, and Arnold Schwarzenegger said in his Austrian accent, he said, "That is not right." He said, "What do you all they have to do is, you know, pay off the politicians, you know. This is a wrong decision." And now, Arnold is not one of my favorite people, but I will say that he was absolutely right there, and he's absolutely right what he's trying to do here in California, so that we really will have representative government. And I think that people have to understand that over 90% of the people oppose the Supreme Court decision. But the Supreme Court, of course, is in our land, not our legislators. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Michael Trudeau, and you pick up that story, and I think this is really such an important issue that we have lost property rights. Our Supreme Court has come out against the Ten Commandments. It cannot be displayed in public buildings or in schools, because, of course, it's a religious document, but we can teach the Earth Charter, recommend in our schools, but it is a pagan, Luciferian document. That's all right to have, but we couldn't have God's Ten Commandments. I think people have to realize our Supreme Court is anti-God. It is perfectly all right to have pagan teaching in our schools to do with Christianity.
Well, an important note about that, all countries' laws are based upon those Ten Commandments. So the fact that that's now being banned from all of the courthouses really does speak volumes as to what's going on in today's society. Another one, of course, is the Real ID Act. You can be told, of course, that this is to slow down the terrorists being able to get on airplanes and so on, but that's, you know, something that is fairly ridiculous when they're already being heard by college students to the point where the police officers can't tell the difference between these new nationals and what the kids are making in their dorm rooms. And this is something that just passed the Senate unanimously. That's a matter of fact, we will all now be a member of the National ID Club. You'll have to have the National ID card if you want to get on a plane, if you want to get on a train, if you want to use government services. Maybe it'll apply to your Social Security check. And considering the fact that when it passed the House, they changed it so that the Secretary of Homeland Security can also, at his decision or her decision, make the decision to simply say, yeah, you need the National ID card for medicine and water now, too. That's another one of our attacks against us. Now you look at some of the other aspects of economic attacks, and you start looking at things like the oil prices closing brand new record, Sachs saying over $100 a barrel in the near future. They're predicting $3, $4, and $5 a gallon gas. So certainly is a negative, but I'm more concerned about what the petroleum costs will do to a loaf of bread price and every other single thing that requires petroleum in its manufacture. Bank employees are being caught everywhere selling our information. Breach recently, you probably caught of 40 million consumers' credit card information and banking information. That's 40 million Americans who literally had their credit card information drift off into cyberspace. So as I said, we certainly already know that things are bad and getting worse. The dollar's decline alone basically spells depression as far as I'm concerned. But rather than discuss the reasons for owning gold, which most of the listeners already know, we thought we'd discuss how you can avoid being taken advantage of by unscrupulous dealers. And believe me, there are plenty of dealers who will put their own interests in front of yours, opting for a fast buck rather than a lifelong commitment.
Could I just, before you get to that, that's such an important issue, but I just wanted to point out two things from what you were saying. Number one, they say we need an ID card because we just can't control our borders. Well, they specifically have not tried to control the borders, so they create the problem to just ID card. And in a similar matter, suddenly we find all this emphasis on identity theft, and Visa has lost $40 million records, you know, and it seems that hardly a week goes by when some other major person doesn't lose their identity information. In other words, our Social Security number goes out and our address and all the personal details. Now, why is it suddenly, just at this time in history, why all this identity theft is taking place? Why are they emphasizing this on television, running ads to tell us about the danger of identity theft? How do you make money, you know, by selling the idea that there may be identity theft? Somebody could steal your credit card and charge these things to you. There's no money to be made, but this is all part of a psychological game they're playing with the American people to convince them there's a danger. And what's the obvious solution? Well, what we really need, if we all had a chip, then, of course, nobody could steal our identity. Why? And when we went to buy or sell, we'd simply have to pass perhaps the back of our right hand over a scanner, and that would scan, and they would know who we are. Is it possible that they're preparing us psychologically? The solution to identity theft is going to be to have a chip implanted in you. And believe me, they're already starting to do this in Mexico with all the people within the police force and the military. They're all getting their chips inserted, and it won't be long before they do that in America, because they're going to try to move us into a cashless society when they collapse the economy. I'm convinced they are, and I think that, Michael, you wanted to pick up and tell people how to avoid some of the scams that are out there that are really being put forward to fleece people who are trying to protect themselves in these uncertain times.
Right, and again, like I mentioned, you know, these people that are out there not necessarily trying to, I guess, set out to fleece people, although believe me, plenty are, but I think a lot of them are just simply basically putting their own interests in front of, you know, your interests as you come into this market. And again, I think they opt for a fast buck rather than taking the time to build a relationship with a lifelong client. And as I mentioned, the Colonial Resources will opt for the slow buck and lifelong client every single time, because we'd rather take the time to educate using our combined experience of over 20 years in the industry building a lifelong client. So I'll tell you what, let's do this. We'll cover some of the scams and some of the ways that you can sniff them out, because I'll tell you, we've talked to so many people, so many of your own listeners, Stan, who've done business with us, who have told us some of the scams that they've run into over the years. And, of course, I've heard plenty over my own experience, but it's very basic, some of these things. So how can you avoid being ripped off? Basically, one of the things that you should do is start to ask questions right away, because if they're not interested in educating you, then the first thing you have to understand is that they're probably more interested in just getting you to part with your money on anything it is that they can get you to buy at that time. Some of the things that you might look to right off the get-go is when I call up a company and say, hi, my name's Joe Smith, and I'm interested in maybe purchasing some metals. If somebody immediately recommends a product to me without explaining anything about the product or how it might best meet a motivation I'm after, then it can tell me right away that they're in or not mine. Now, is that something that makes sense, Dan?
Well, it certainly does. Right. The thing is that I think that the average individual out there is incredibly naive. We've lived in a fiat money system going back to 1913, and certainly this country, the average individual, has not traded in gold going back to the 1930s and in silver since the 19th. Johnson removed the silver backing from our currency. So they don't really understand what people throughout the rest of the world understand, is that, you know, a fiat money system is simply a paper promise to pay and is as good as the integrity and honesty of the government that issues it. And the question is, you know, Is our government really honest? Do other countries really trust what the American politicians say? Are other countries and other people trying to get out of the dollar? And I think increasingly they are. And we know that certainly Warren Buffett is investing in foreign currencies. He says the dollar is going to go down. Bill Gates is investing in foreign currencies. He says the dollar is going to go down. George, he's investing in foreign currencies because the dollar is going to go down. And those people are a lot smarter than I am. So people who want to protect themselves, they really don't understand how to go about doing
well,
that. And
right.
I think that perhaps you would be able to offer them some suggestions.
You know, those three gentlemen that you brought up in some cases have put themselves into positions of owning multiple millions of dollars of gold and silver. So, again, you know, this is something that if you see the smart big money guys doing it, it's a pretty good indication that you should be doing it, too. They're doing it for the financial protection. You can do it for the financial protection as well as for the protection against the coming cashless society for barter purposes. You can use this to pass your wealth down. It's just a wonderful thing and a very safe thing to own because the value of gold, the buying power remains the same. So the first question that comes to mind is, how much gold for the dollar are you getting? So if you call up and you say, yeah, I want some coins, and you realize that what you're after a lengthy discussion is specifically, let's say, you're interested in private transactions, no reporting requirements, and you want something that's exempt from current confiscation laws, which is something we would recommend, the next thing comes down to getting the most gold for the buck. So how much gold in that circumstance for the dollar should you get? Well, as an example, today, spot gold closed at around $440 an ounce. Now, to own the privately traded gold in either a quarter ounce or a half ounce or a full ounce coin, you should be paying approximately $525 to $600 as a maximum in any combination to make the ounce, whether it be four quarter ounce pieces, two half ounce pieces, a half ounce piece and two quarter ounce pieces, or a full ounce coin. It shouldn't make any difference. You should be paying no more than $525 to $600, and again, in any combination. And all dealers buy these item coins basically at the same price. It's what gets tacked on afterwards. Most dealers will take a coin that they paid $100 for and add another $50, whereas we went to $20. And again, that's one of the basic be looking for is what kind of a margin are they talking about. You have to be realizing that there's a bid and an ask for coins. In other words, you are buying on an ask. If you sell your coins, you're selling on the bid, just like on a stock. So one of the very good questions to ask is, if I buy a coin today at this price, buy that coin back from me today at what price? You'll get that information and you'll have that spread. You can do, if you're talking to a dealership or a company and they're telling you something that you should be looking at buying, ask them that question, find out what that spread is, and then again you can call other companies like ours and ask the same question and find out whether that spread is in line with what the general norm should be. We're being talked into getting high-grade certified coins at inflated prices or coins that don't meet the client's motivation. And I touched on that in the beginning, again, calling in with the basic information of, I think I need to own gold, and I've got some money, but I really don't know much about coins. Having somebody say, well, I think you ought to get a 63 St. Gaudens would be ridiculous. They don't know what your motivating factor for ownership is, and we need to talk about that.
All right, fine. Well, Michael Trudeau is with Colonial Resources, and don't really need to know if they're going to get anything in the way of gold and silver. They've got to know what the market is, because I know so many people have gone to people with a fairly good reputation, and you know, they bought expensive gold coins, and of course they have actually lost their shirts on this. So you have to be very, very skeptical. You have to check. You have to shop around. But the most important thing is find out really how much of a markup there is on these things over the actual base price of gold or the base cost of that coin. We'll be back in just a moment with Michael Trudeau of Colonial Resources, and, well, welcome your calls. All right, Michael, go ahead.
Stan, a lot of people are being talked into getting these high-grade certified coins, and not to say that that's a terrible thing to own is high-grade certified coins, but you got to own them for the right reason. If you're owning high-grade certified coins, basic motivations for ownership of high-grade coins would be, I'm a profit seeker, so I'm in a speculative market and I can afford to lose money on these coins, or because I'm simply a hobbyist and I'm trying to complete my collection similar to doing a stamp collection or something along that line. Those are the two basic reasons why you would own high-grade certified coins, and basically they're the only reasons you should.
But, you know, so often, Michael, I will hear people say that, well, of course, this coin dealer told them that there were these foreign coins from British Guiana or from Austria, you know, and there was just a limited supply of them, a few thousand, and so they wanted to buy these. They tell them this would be a good buy, and they buy these coins, and then when they want to sell them, they find out that they're not worth anywhere near as much as they paid for them.
Absolutely. Another example of that would be when somebody gets talked into buying one of those high-priced foreign gold coins, which turn out to be a bullion product to begin with, would not trade privately, would be subject to confiscation. But most importantly to me, I live in a rural farm country, and I understand that if it comes down to a situation where I literally, and, you know, I certainly pray that it would never, but if it does come down to a situation where I have to use my gold and silver to barter for goods and services with my neighbors, my farmer neighbor a mile down the road knows what a U.S. gold coin is, so he's seen them before. He has no idea what a French rooster looks like and whether it's actually gold or not. It's one of the things that you have to think of as well. And again, it's a simple matter of the coins you should be getting if you're interested in privacy and protection are going to fall into one criteria, and that's basically American-made coins that are pre-1933 in circulated grades, or you want to be looking at the modern commemorative gold coin series, which come in either proof or business strikes. These coins legally trade as collectibles in any of those categories, plus they are exempt from confiscation, and of course, being collectibles, they also trade privately. So again, that's the same thing you're after. It's a simple matter of getting the most gold for the dollar. People should be getting increments of quarter ounce and half ounce coins like the $5 and $10 coins because, again, if it ever does come down to barter, smaller pieces will be easier to work with. They're certainly a little bit more portable and a little bit more private, I think, easier to hide as well. And again, it's not to say that you shouldn't own high-grade coins. It's you should own them for the right motivation. If you're simply looking to protect your money, your buying power as the dollar's declining, or whether you want barter coins, something like that, again, get pre-33 American or the modern commemorative gold coin series, and make sure that if you get the pre-33 American, you're getting them in the circulated grades. And again, same scenario, as a base price of about $440 an ounce spot gold, you don't want to pay any more than the $525 to $600 as a maximum. When it comes down to delivery and payment method, we want to talk about a couple of things. Be wary of any company immediately that does business using Federal Express specifically or UPS, unless you have specifically requested that they do so because you want shipment or something to happen in a specified amount of time. If they suggest using Federal Express or UPS or any other third-party service besides the United States Postal Service, that's something to be wary of and use as a red flag or an alarm, because using an outside party or a third-party service allows avoid having to look at any type of a federal felony offense, like should they be ripping you off. If they're ripping you off, they will avoid using the mail service. A lot of them will anyways, because they'll know that if they get caught, it's a federal offense.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Michael was saying something that I'd never even thought of. Now, ordinarily, when you buy coins through the mail, you know, you're buying them from somebody. Why you ordinarily get them certified postal delivery? And you would not think of it, but this is a very, very safe way of doing it. It's insured up to $25,000. And the important thing is that, you know, you'll get it. I mean, the federal government is as incompetent as it may seem at times. At least as far as the postal service, if that's registered, is it registered mail? Or how does it go?
Yep. We always send everything through registered insured mail. And again, I have not lost a package in over 15 years of delivering packages of gold and silver. But should it ever happen, every time, because I insist on insurance, as well as registered receipt requested. Again, it means that every single person in the mail department, from the clerk who picks it up to the person who drops it off in your hands, has to sign for it, including you. In addition, regular postal packages, which might be left in a bin overnight, because yours is registered insured, it's locked up in a vault overnight.
And I think the interesting thing that Michael brought out was that, you know, if the person you're dealing with is not honorable, why, if they are honorable, they'll want to ship this to the postal. If they suggest Federal Express or UPS, we'll want to be very, very careful, because if they ship it through the mail and they rip you off, why, that is a federal offense. If they ship it UPS or FedEx, why, of course, you don't have that protection. In other words, you don't have that degree of protection. And the one thing you really don't want to ever do is fool with the government as far as, you know, trying to rip somebody off through the mail. That is a very serious offense. Would that be a fair statement?
It's a big red flag, because, again, it's the way that they protect themselves from this federal felony offense, by simply avoiding using the Postal Service at all. So if they avoid using the Postal Service, especially if it's, I'm going to have Federal Express stop by and pick up your check, or you send me a check, Federal Express, because I've got to have payment in order to get these coins and bought to buy tomorrow, yada, yada, or you'll lose them. Again, it's that type of a thing that you've got to... And that's another thing I want to bring up, is if somebody's pressuring you to buy coins, the first thing I would tell you to do is turn tail and run. It's a simple matter of, you know what, there really is no such thing as the pressure. Coins go. Sometimes availability is tough on certain products. I can certainly testify to it. But that being said, there are certainly other products that can step into their place that will do fairly the same thing that you're after. So if somebody's pressuring you with this as a must-do thing, again, it's one of those things that you can look at as being a possibility of a scam. Sometimes it's accurate that it's you know, the coins have to be sold right away, because literally they may not have access to hold on to them from their suppliers. So again, it's just something to kind of be wary of. When it comes down to the delivery of your product, your coins should be shipped within 1 week of us receiving a check or another firm receiving a check, if it's a personal check. I will tell you that it takes time to clear a personal check. No one in the business will take the chance of being ripped off, so they will hold a personal check. We recommend you use a personal check personally, because it leaves you with the least amount of a paper trail for anyone else to follow. If, for instance, you're using like a bank wire, though, or if you're using a cashier's check or something that would be deemed as good funds immediate, then your product should be shipped literally within as little as 24 hours. The two larger companies that I've worked for in the past, which will remain nameless, typically have shipped after 4 to 6 weeks for delivery, and in a lot of cases, months. And there's absolutely no reason for that whatsoever. If a company is typically telling you that it's going to take weeks and weeks to ship your coins, what they're basically saying is, we're going to hold your money for a while and earn a little money ourselves instead of you earning it while we wait for these coins to come in, or while we wait to ship you your coins.
Or maybe we wait for the price to go down, and because the problem was up there in a real trouble.
And I've seen that happen with companies who have tried to do it as well. So again, that's one of those things where you can ask right off the bat, and it's something you should ask right away. How long is it going to take to get my coins? If they tell you anything longer than 5 days or 7 business days from the time they receive your check, again, it's a red flag that says these guys are taking advantage of me and my no question. Another thing is if they tell you right off the get-go when talking with you, well, how much do you have to put into this, because we've got a minimum purchase requirement? Well, in reality, there really is no such thing as a minimum purchase requirement. You don't need hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of dollars to get involved. Some of our clients literally spend a couple of $100. Everybody who seeks protection does a service.
All right, fine. Well, when we get back, we're going to welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. If you're interested in knowing something about the gold and silver market, Michael's in this, and I think it's a good idea to understand how this system works. It's a little scary when you first get involved, and if you don't know how the system works, why, well, you're sort of in a defensive position. Realize, of course, there are some very, very good, responsible people out there, and realize also that there's some real charlatans and real sharks in this business, and, well, we've had our own experience with those. We'll tell you a little about that when we get back here at Radio Liberty. Yeah, this is Dr. Stan, and this is our guest this evening is Michael Trudeau, and he's simply talking about some of the perils that exist out there for people who do get into the coin market. So pick up your story from there, Michael.
Sure. One of the other things that immediately comes to mind when people are out to take a little bit of advantage on you maybe is when they don't own physical possession coins or metals. They might tell you, for instance, that what we're doing is we're putting you into this position of gold or silver, but we're going to store it at our special facility. Because, again, it's one of those things where you have to take a look at this and say, you know, if the chips were down, so to speak, and there was an absolute all-out catastrophe, depression, collapse of society as we know it, who's going to give you that metal back? I mean, can you really count on being able to, if you can get there, knocking on the door of some big facility and saying, yeah, here's my card, I've got some metals in there that I'd like to put in my wheelbarrow and, you know, waddle home with? That becomes a bit ridiculous. And again, more than likely in a lot of those cases, you're being ripped off. The position of metals doesn't exist in a facility. They're simply hoping that if enough of you don't come at the same time asking for your metals, they'll be able to cough up with enough of it at any given time to give it back to you. Another thing is never, ever, ever buy on credit. I am dealing with people on many occasions who have been told by companies that they should buy gold and silver on their credit cards, because even though they might be paying 12, 19, 20% interest, 24% interest, that the gold market's going to increase enough to compensate them for that interest that they're paying on their credit cards, which is ridiculous because nobody knows whether gold will go up 10%, 9%, or any percent in any particular period of time. In addition to which, if you're buying metal on credit, I have to tell you that you're doing it the wrong way. The first thing you should be doing is paying off the credit and then buying the metals. So again, it's one of those things where, you know, that's one of the things that you can say to yourself, you know, I'm hearing this a lot and I'm feeling these things from these people and this guy's really trying to pressure me and, you know, so on and so forth. I want to talk a little bit more about the margin aspect and why, in my opinion, those margins are where they are. Because, again, these margins are sometimes in these bigger companies 30, 40, 50% or even. And a lot of it is because the owners of these companies want to drive really fancy cars and live lavish lifestyles. And I've watched them drive off in their Jags and so on in their wonderful, you know, thousands of dollar Armani suits. And so on. There are marketing aspects that come into play and the advertising dollars that they spend. Well, that all has to be recouped. When you run an ad in the Wall Street Journal, it can literally run you $175,000 at a crack, and you've got to get that money back. You can't just throw it down a hole. So these companies are basically taking the product that we and they buy at the same price, and as I have to cover my lifestyle...
Hold that stuff right there, Michael. Go ahead. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Michael Trudeau from Colonial Resources. And before we go on, Michael, I would like you to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you, get to your website, sure. And if they would like to get any information that you have available for them, how can they reach you?
Sure. If you're considering gold as a position of protection or as a way to pass down your wealth and want to sidestep the scams and deal with an honest company, you can call us toll-free at any time. And the number is 1-800-685-4042. And again, it's 1-800-685-4042. And we can certainly take the time to discuss more in depth, certainly than we can cover in an hour tonight, some of these scams that are out there, because there's, you know, plenty of things for you to look for. The other thing, too, is if you've already bought metals and coins in the past, it's important to track your position and know where you stand. As you mentioned earlier, Stan, some items in the market are up as high as 70%, while other things have dropped significantly. We will be happy to give you current values on your position, as well as show you how you can track them yourselves in most cases. I'll tell you, most dealers don't want you to do that because they want you to rely on their information, which could be skewed to their side of seeing things. But again, we can show you how you can track most of these items that you own already yourselves, as well as give you current value. And again, it's a toll-free call at 1-800-685-4042. Now, Stan, is that, you know, basically you hire large staffs of brokers or call centers, and although there are a couple of us here to answer calls tonight, we are in Minnesota. It's a couple hours ahead of most of the listenership. So if you do call and you get a voicemail, please leave us your name and phone number. We're the best time to call you back, and we will get back to you within 24 hours, I promise you. And again, if you've already purchased metals and you're kind of wondering, gee, did I get taken advantage of, you don't have to feel embarrassed about it because it happens to a lot of people. The more important part is to take a look at what you've got going on now and see if you can't put yourself then in a better position. There's a woman who recently called us who basically had bought some coins that she'd been paying almost $1,100 for, $1,095 a piece. And she called and, you know, had mentioned, gee, I heard your ad on Dr. Stan's show, and I want to know if I'm being taken advantage of by this company. Here's what I've been getting. And it was literally a matter of hearing this woman say that she'd been buying these items at almost $1,100 per coin, and we had to have the sad information come back to her that the current value on these products was about $2-$2.50. And this is something that had been going on with this woman for quite some time. So, again, that's certainly a glaring example, and we hear other glaring examples. But some examples are significant enough that it adds up. I mean, again, if you're paying $30 or $40 or $50 more for a coin from one company than you could, and you're talking about buying, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 or 100 coins, or even in some cases 400 or 500 coins, now you're talking about some highly significant dollar amounts and a lot different amount of gold for your dollar. And again, after all, that's what this is about, is getting the most protection for the dollar that you can.
Okay, well, somebody just called in and asked if you had heard stories of some kind of impending financial shock to the United States in July or August, and also could the real estate market be nearing a peak. So why don't you just take in, you know, what about, we hear all sorts of scare stories all the time. There was one that was circulated about 2 weeks ago about Julian Robertson on CNBC making some statements, and it circulated all over the Internet, and there was a story, a video from CNBC, and it just really wasn't true. In other words, they were really trying to scare the people. Somebody was putting out disinformation. And so we're always hearing these stories really to make us sort of fearful. Have you heard any things of that, or do you think this is simply more of the hype to frighten people into reacting?
Well, you know, here's the thing. I can point to quite a few things right now. For number one, of course, July economically is not always what you'd call one of the better months of the year. So that's certainly one significant aspect right off. But speakers at the recent New York Institutional Gold Conference predicted that the price of spot gold could get as high as $850 a troy ounce in coming months from its current level, slightly in excess of about $439 today. Economists contend that this means investors are leaning toward the precious metal and not the dollar hedge against future inflation. I want to point out that the last time gold got anywhere near the projected high in the 1970s, when we had out-of-control inflation, unrest in the Middle East, and an oil crisis pushing the precious metals from $150 to $848 in a very brief period of time. And you got to ask yourself, inflation, unrest in the Middle East, and oil crisis. So that's one thing that I look at. Well, the other thing is getting into this housing market aspect is that they're raising interest rates right now. From 1990 through 2005, if you look at all the refis that happened across America, over 60% of those refis happened on floating ARMs. So now what you've got is this humongous bubble of people out there in houses who bought into these wonderful houses while the market was just cruising. I mean, how can you lose? People are making money hand over fist. I can buy this property. It's going to be worth $1 zillion down the line. I'll do anything to get it. I'll take any risk or credit and dive on in. So give me the floating ARM, sure. Interest rates are going to stay at 0% for the rest of my life.
And for the ARM, when he refers to, is the adjustable rate mortgage. In other words, that's very low at the present time, but also adjustable rate mortgages very seldom go down. They usually go up, and when they go up dramatically.
Absolutely, and of course now what you've got is these people who have bought into these things who are right there at the nines. They've spent, so every penny they take in goes to paying off their debts. The very first thing that happens as they start to raise those interest rates and the pinch gets felt is they start the triage. They immediately begin hacking off things that they can afford to lose pretty much and still get, you know, to work and so on. So first goes the second car and so on. But eventually what happens is they lose the house. And at that point, you're going to see a market collapse that's going to be absolutely catastrophic in this country. I think that we're seeing the actual beginnings of this right now begin to happening as real estate values are beginning to fall in areas of the country for the first time in an awful long time on this big run-up. And again, one of those things that you have to look at is, where is the real estate market? Well, it's at its absolute peak, the highest it's ever been. Could it keep going? Of course it could. But at the same time, it's eventually got to have to fall. And if it's at its very highest peak, can I squeak out just one more dollar? It's a possibility, but you also stand to lose all of it. So again, it's one of those things where it's so risky to be on that market bubble where you've got the everything stock market with everything you had in value right at its last peak just before the crash. And again, it's one of those things, in my opinion, to be diving into the real estate market as a big investment for yourself.
Well, I was reading some interesting figures that the value of our housing in the United States is something up about $70 trillion. Now, these are sums of money that we find almost impossible to accept. And yet $70 trillion is actually the government's unfunded debt for Social Security. But there is no way we can maintain a housing market as it is today. And what Americans don't understand, we've seen really gradual increase in housing prices over the last 50 years. There have been a few recessions there, a few times the housing market has dropped off, but ordinarily it's been one of progressive increase. I had the interesting experience of talking to a young woman from Japan, and she was commenting on the American housing market and how here in the United States, every year your house becomes more valuable. She says that's not how it is in Japan. And of course, you remember in 1990, 1991, why the value of property in Tokyo alone was greater than the value of all the property in the United States put together. Just in the city of Tokyo and the surrounding area, the value of that property was so high. But it was a bubble, and it began to fall. And in Japan, every year, the value of houses goes down. It doesn't go up. It goes down and progressively has been falling 15 years. And they just can't get their economy going again. People don't trust the economy. And this is what uncontrolled deflation. And, of course, the one thing the economists fear here in the United States more than anything else is the fact that the same thing could happen here when the prudence in the value of the fiat money system that we have. So I think people really have to understand that every bubble breaks, whether it be the tulip mania that they had in Holland many years ago or the land speculation they had in Florida, 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. There have been many, many bubbles. We saw a stock market bubble in 1999 and year 2000. And, of course, the NASDAQ has never gotten back from the dramatic fall from 11,000 down to a little over 2,000 today. And the people who invested in that, they were simply wiped out. Could it happen again? I believe it not only can happen, I believe this real estate bubble has created tremendous liquidity, but, of course, there's nothing behind it. It is all a perception. It is all an illusion. Would you agree with that, Michael?
Absolutely. And when we talk about people losing confidence at some point in the dollar, you have to ask yourself, when will that occur? I mean, you know, I'm looking at an annual drop-off in purchasing power on the dollar over the last 3 years at 12%+. And, I mean, you have to start looking at these terms because, again, and I like to use this analogy because I think it makes people really realize how this is affecting them personally, and that is that if it's 25% in the last 2 years, that means that just 2 years ago, a $100 bill that bought you 4 bags of groceries for your family, today will buy you 3. And that's a significant difference in the amount of food that your family can afford, or gasoline, or anything in what your family can afford. And ask yourself, with that kind of a decline of 25% in 2 years, in that two-year period, did you receive a 25% raise at your place of employment? I can't imagine anyone did. Can you think of any investments that you had outside of the possibility of gold or property that paid that kind of interest on what you did? I don't think so. So again, just about anything that you could have been in is something that you lost buying power on, and we're working pretty hard for this buying power, what the Fed allows us to keep, which is infinitesimal. It seems to me you'd really want to fight to keep more of it and protect it, and I'll tell you, you can't do it by hoping the government comes to our rescue soon with this economic bailout. It says, all right, we've put the squeeze on them enough through this depression. We've got enough of their property foreclosed on. Let's give them a boom time again now and have everybody happy with new jobs. Right now, we're sliding downward, and again, you can see it almost everywhere you look. You look over to GM, for instance, one of the employers of the country and one of the great economic powerhouses of the country. Their bonds are rated junk status. They've got SUVs littering the showroom floors. No one will buy them knowing that gasoline is going to $3, $4, $5 a gallon. And at the same time, they're talking about, oh, did you guys have a pension here? We're sorry. In addition to which, we're going to start laying you off in the tens of thousands. You go to the airline industry, which got whacked by 9/11, and now, of course, you've got these airlines coming out and saying, gee, I don't think we can afford to pay these folks pension. That's okay. Luckily, the government's got the pension protection fund, which it currently doesn't really have. So as these companies start saying, and it's not just the airlines and the auto industry, it's plenty of others who are starting to default on these pensions, I'm telling you, this is really going to get ugly. And long before this gets any better, we are going to get much worse. And I think that when we start talking about a dollar decline of 12.5% annual, I'm going to go ahead and say, hey, folks, we're in a depression right now. A 25% drop on my buying power in 2 years is pretty darn depressing.
Well, I think that people really have to understand that the government is putting out figures, you know, and it's the old saying that figures don't lie, but liars can figure. And they tell us that our inflation rate is maybe 3% now, 3.5%. If you believe that inflation is 3.5%, what's happened to the price of gasoline? If you believe that inflation is 3.5%, what's happened to the prices of housing? If you believe that inflation is 3.5%, what's happened to the health care costs, if you're paying for them yourself, or what's happened to the food costs? They simply make up statistics. They have people who are well paid to make up statistics, and they're making up because they're trying to keep the American people from really understanding what is really taking place in our society today. People have to understand the history of finances. They have to understand what a fiat money system is. They have to know the history of fiat money systems. There's nothing new under the sun. They had a fiat money system in ancient Greece. And Aristotle said, and you'll find the quotation in Bartlett's famous quotations, he says there's nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with a fiat money system, as long as you have perfect authority and godlike wisdom in Kings. You've heard that quotation before, but you'll hear it again. Aristotle said, there's absolutely nothing wrong with fiat money as long as you have perfect authority and godlike wisdom in Kings. Who among our listening audience really thinks we have godlike wisdom in the White House today? And if we don't have godlike wisdom, how long will we be able to keep this house of cards intact? And it is going to come tumbling down. That is why even members of the Russian mafia over in Russia are trying to get out of the American dollars, because they see it declining in values. Why other countries are subtly trying to dump their American dollars. And, of course, I think the most exciting thing, Michael, and I'm sure you're well aware of this, is that the Arab countries, there are, I don't know, about 50 of them, and, of course, they tie into all the Muslim nations, are planning on setting up an Arab bank, a trans-Arab bank, or a Muslim bank that will have a different reserve currency and will not allow usury. And, of course, they want that, bring the dollar, pardon me, the oil barrels, you know, into a relationship to the dinar. In other words, they will accept gold dinars or whatever the dinar is in relationship to oil, and that will become the means by which oil is purchased. Have you heard that?
Absolutely. In addition to which, you have to look at the fact that right now the Middle East nations are getting very fat on the fact that these petroleum dollars are skyrocketing, and these guys are just basically collecting it all. And I promise you that they're not taking these profits and stuffing them into paper assets. They're putting it into precious metals to protect it, just like, you know, you and I might. And again, this is one of those things that these guys, you know, see coming. Again, it's everywhere. It used to be, Stan, that you would have to, in my job, you'd have to look far and wide for this information and to kind of see what's really happening out there. And now what I'm hearing from, you know, people who call us is they're coming to me and saying, boy, I heard this and I heard this and I heard this and I heard this and I heard, and they just run down this huge gamut of things, and you just go, yeah. And on top of it, you're scratching the surface. Here's 300 more terrifying economic things and terrifying political things that we're facing as a country right now. And the relief that you usually might see, the light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak, isn't there. And in most cases, if it is, you're probably afraid it's probably a train.
Well, I agree with you. I think that the what's happening to the price of oil, I think we haven't had. I think that they plan to increase the price of oil. Now, supposedly one reason we went to war to have the access, yet, of course, ever since we went to war in the Middle East, the price of oil has been going up. But people can't understand that they would say one thing and they would do the other. They plan on raising the price of oil for a number of purposes. One is to get us out of our cars. That has always been a major goal of the people who work behind the scenes. And the other thing is, of course, it is going to simply destroy our economy, because things are delivered by truck. That's going to raise the cost of everything that is related to transportation. It's going to raise airfares. It's going to raise the price of, you know, the food that you buy in your grocery stores, and cost of the things, the products you buy, and you know, at Sears or Kmart. Well, Michael, we're just about out of time.
Sure.
We want to get out your telephone number just
Absolutely.
One more time.
The number is 1-800-685-4242. 1-800-480-4242 or visit the website colonialresources.com. And I want to mention real quick on the $60 plus oil, imagine everything that's made out of plastic and how much petroleum it takes to make that.
All right, fine. I guess this evening has been Michael Trudeau and the Colonial Resources. Michael does keep Radio Liberty on the air here. We're going to be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Michael, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, one thing I want to start by saying is, Stan, it's certainly an absolute pleasure for us to help support the things that you do. I want to mention to the listeners that I've known you for, you know, many years, that I've worked with you in the past in the radio business as well as what we're doing today as a sponsor and a supporter of your program. And it's important for me to be a sponsor of your message that you get out, not just tonight's message, of course, which I think hopefully is helping a lot of people, precious metals, or have considered the precious metals. But I'm talking about other things that you bring to the table, so to speak, because I listen to your show quite often, and I have so much knowledge that I've picked up and gained from listenership over the years of listening to your programs and as well as, you know, reading your books. And it's one of those things where I feel very positive about doing it, simply in the fact that I am helping you to help everybody else out there in the listenership to gain more knowledge, and certainly in respect of what's going on politically, I guess a better edge to not be taken advantage of by the politicos who pretty much pull all of the strings.
Well, I appreciate your words of encouragement, and certainly we appreciate your help. But I think it's so vitally important that people begin to make preparations for what I think are difficult times that lie ahead. And certainly they should make preparations financially. They should make preparations as far as the possibility of some sort of a major cataclysmic event, and that would be a nuclear, a biological or chemical war. And if you read the latest issue of the magazine put out by the Council on Foreign Relations, which is America's invisible government, there are actually 3 lead articles on the danger of a chemical, of a attack on America, because they're not calling it a biological attack, they're calling it an influenza epidemic. But as I read that article and those articles, I have a feeling that they're telling us something. People said, there is going to be a major influenza epidemic. Not there will be sometime in the future, there is going to be one. And they're trying to frighten us into creating a situation of fear, but perhaps they know something that we don't know. And like my suggestion is, make your preparations physically, make your preparations financially, make your preparations spiritually, because behind everything going on, there's strong spiritual forces at work, and if you do not have a proper relationship with our Lord, I will tell you that you're not going to get through what I believe are the very difficult times that are lying before us. Michael, do you have one parting thought for our listeners?
Yeah, I would. The one thing that you just mentioned, which was the bird flu aspect, that's something that was certainly, you know, we're hearing a lot about, and it's in the news, and it may be a very, very serious threat. We don't know, of course, whether it's a line from the government of disinformation or whether it's accurate. What I can tell you is the number one source that I have found for information on that subject, as well as all types of things like SARS, ARC Institute with a K, arcinstitute.com.
And we've been having, of course, Jerry Goodetti here on Radio Liberty on a regular basis. In fact, we have her lined up on arms for this coming month. Thank you so very much for being with us, Michael.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Good night. Bye-bye. Sure. And, ladies and gentlemen, I wanted to read something here, which I think is very, very apropos to what we've been talking about. And this was written in 1965, and it says this: in the absence of the gold standard, debt savings from the confiscation through inflation, there is no safe store of value. If there were, the government would have to make its holding illegal, as was done in the case of gold. The financial policy of the welfare state requires that there is no way for the owners of wealth to protect themselves. This is the shabby secret of the welfare state's tirade against gold. Deficit spending is simply a scheme for the confiscation of wealth. That was written in 1965 by a man named Alan Greenspan. So that was exactly what's going on today. And he is playing the game. I do not know what his motivation is. But whatever his motivation is, we are headed towards a cataclysmic event, as Paul Volcker said on the 10th of April of this year in an article in the Washington Post. I don't know whether it'll come with a bang or a whimper, whether it'll come sooner or later. But there is going to be a crisis, and I fear it's going to be. So begin making your preparations. However you do it is up to you. but realize we live in very uncertain times. And also remember that there's never been an instance in all history where a nation has turned against God, where God has not eventually abandoned that nation. So let me simply point out, we have a great talk. It's called The Coming Financial Crisis. And we actually are putting together all of my newsletters, and they will be available here by next week. And you'll be able to read the four financial newsletters that we've actually written on this subject. But you can order that. It's called The Coming Financial Crisis. It's the talk we gave about 6 weeks ago in Southern California. It's just about everything you need to know. Not only about the history of money, but the occult forces that are working within the monetary system. And that's exactly what I said, the occult forces that have been working within the monetary system since the days of the ancient Templars, and then going into the formation of the banks here in the United States, the First Bank of the United States, the Second Bank of the United States, and the Federal Reserve System. Because behind the whole central banking system are spiritual forces, and if you don't recognize that, if you don't realize we're fighting a spiritual battle on a political and ideological battlefield, you can't understand what's going on. If you'd like to know more about my talk on the coming financial crisis or the booklets we're going to be having available, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, if you haven't read Ed Griffin's wonderful book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, which tells the story of how the monetary system works. A system that is built entirely upon debt has absolutely nothing behind it, other than, of course, an illusion. It's all a matter of illusion and perception. And as long as they can keep you believing that money has value, that fiat money has value, why, of course, you'll continue utilizing. Remember what George Santayana had written, as those who cannot remember history are condemned to repeat it. And of course, it was Thomas Jefferson who, writing back in the early 1800s, said, "We are about to be ruined by a deluge of paper, formerly by the old continental." And it was Daniel Webster, writing in about 1835, who said, "Of all the contrivances for cheating the laboring classes of mankind, none has been more effective than that which deludes them with paper money." So if you'd like, of course, to get more information, my talk on the coming financial crisis, The Creature from Jekyll Island by Ed Griffin, if you'd like to get, of course, the book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy by Professor Sutton, remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Let me suggest the main newsletter and pray for America. We'll be back for our next hour right after this. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We hope to have with us in just a moment here Kevin Abrams, who is co-author of a book called The Pink Swastika. And it's the story of the homosexual influence within the Nazi Party. In fact, the homosexual forces that brought Adolf Hitler to power. And what most people do not understand is that there was a strong occult influence within the Nazi movement. In fact, the entire Nazi movement was based upon the occult. If you read the book written by Corinne McLaughlin and Gordon Davidson entitled Spiritual Politics, and they're both deeply involved with the world occult movement, why, they will tell you that the Adolf Hitler was deeply involved within the cult himself, and he really, of course, was under demonic and satanic influence. Also, of course, the fact that Winston Churchill had prevailed upon the judges at the Nuremberg trials not to bring out any mention of the occult influence of the Nazi movement. You're supposed to think that these were just a bunch of wackos. They were not. They were a part of this world occult or esoteric or satanic movement, call it what you will, but it is a very real movement. And, of course, one of the major forces behind bringing Hitler's movement to power were the homosexuals. They were led by a fellow named... And, well, I'm going to let Kevin Abrams tell you a lot more about it because he's really studied this. Hi, Kevin. How are you tonight?
Good evening, Dr. Monteith. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Why don't you pick up and tell our listeners how you got interested in this story of the origins of the Nazi movement and their relationship to the homosexual movement. We've been told about how terribly the homosexuals were treated under the Nazis, but what indeed is the truth of what happened?
Well, it's a bit like the riddle of the Sphinx, the riddle of homosexuality. Nazis were simultaneously militant gay pederasts while being opposed to homosexuality. They did not like the effeminate model of homosexuality, considering them to be emasculated gossips and something that went wrong in their early childhood rearing. But the Nazis themselves were led by, in the early years, led by a fellow by the name of Adolf Brandt. They founded their own newspaper called the Agene, which roughly translated is the community of the special. And they felt that sexual relationships between older males and young boys was an expression of a superior superior class of people, the Übermenschen type individual, which is what the Nazis were all about, was the eugenics, racial eugenics, the engineering of a superior class over or an Übermenschen race of Aryan people. So it was all predicated upon Nazi racial science. Actually, the T4 program of the early euthanasia that occurred in Germany, which preceded the Holocaust itself, was an expression of whereby they eliminated the useless eaters and the people who were considered to be mentally incapacitated or whatever.
Oh,
there were some
right.
80,000
right
Germans.
Well, Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Kevin Abrams, and we're talking about the background of the Nazi movement, and Kevin was just saying that initially within Hitler's Germany, they started out sterilizing the people with mental defects or with physical defects, and then they started actually killing off the useless eaters, the people who were not productive, the people who had lives that really weren't living, and so the state decided who would live and who would die. Pick up the story there, Kevin.
Yes, and so that was the Übermenschen or the super race model of thought, and they had the designs, global designs. You know, even though The Nazi movement was known as the National Socialist Movement. It was a form of socialism. It was the flip side to communist socialism. They used to call Nazi socialism National Socialism, where, in effect, they were international in scope. There were Nazi movements in Canada, the United States, and South America, and etc. And of course, they often served as fifth column type for Nazi interests. But the Nazi movement was dominated by a homo-fascist cult of the pederast model, very much in tune with the NAMBLA organization, which would be the North American Man-Boy Love Association, which is relationships between men and young boys. That would be referred to as being pederastilia, which is both gender. The Nazis were opposed, like I mentioned before, against the effeminate. They down upon feminized males as being, as they said, emasculated gossips, and they persecuted a number of those. Jane Stickley, a gay Holocaust historian, and probably a homosexual Holocaust historian, documents about 5,000 Pink Triangle prisoners who were either sex tortured or worked to death in German prison camps, concentration centers, and so forth. Not death camps. You know, there was a big difference between a prison camp and a concentration or an extermination center. There were primarily six extermination centers where there were actually thousands of concentration camps where they imprisoned political, you know, enemies and so forth. Even Germans were Catholic priests. Whatever, whoever opposed the military and political agenda of the Nazi regime. So they were very militant. The brown shirts were dominated by Ernst Röhm, who was a flagrant gay pederast.
And just to hold that thought, would be bringing our stations right back on board right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Kevin Abrams, and he's the co-author of a book written with Scott Lively called The Pink Swastika. And Kevin is saying that there's certainly the Nazi movement was pretty brought to power by a group of so-called brown shirts. They were led by Ernst Röhm, who was a well-known homosexual. They were the major driving force behind Hitler's ascent to power. They were working, of course, with this National Socialist Movement. In fact, it was Röhm who had actually recognized the genius of Hitler and had recommended him to the leaders of the National Socialist Party. So pick up the story there.
Actually, in the early days, it was called the German Workers' Party, and Röhm was actually a scout for some of the top officers of the German military. And they were seeking a return to the prominence of the German military in German society. They had been restricted to 100,000 members after the Treaty of Versailles, and they resented that quite heavily. And so there was a lot of secret accumulation of weapons and so forth that was going on. There were quite a few political assassinations, some 300 that occurred during the war of democratic leaders. So the militarists, the Prussian militarists, the Prussian aristocrats, the Junkers, the landowners, and the heavy industrialists were very resentful of the Treaty of Versailles. And but we won't go into that whole area because it's a discussion on its own. But Ernst Röhm he actually discovered Hitler and noticed that he had the power of speech and the ability to persuade his audiences quite effectively, and enlisted him as what they perceived to be as the political mouthpiece of a new movement, and to bring the old powers back into the fore, and to undermine the Democratic Republic or Weimar Republic, which survived from 1918 to 1933, when Hitler finally ascended to the throne, so to speak, of the Chancellor, and they assumed absolute power. That was in January of 1933, but the people from the, you know, street level were the brown shirts, the stormtroopers led by Ernst Röhm, and Ernst Röhm surrounded himself with a clique of fellow homosexual and gay pederasts, people like Edmund Hines and Mann, and in the early days, Gerhard Rossbach, the leader of the Rossbach organization, which was a totally militant gay pederast group, and they had a youth contingent underneath them that was involved in the same type of activity. And so it was the Brown Shirt organization, like the Brown Shirt itself, was Gerhard Rossbach's idea. That's a figure, an individual that's not often mentioned in German history is Gerhard Rossbach, but yet he played a very prominent role. And he came out of the Freikorps movement, the freebooters that sort of wandered around. There's 160 or so different freebooter organizations, loosely organized military organizations that had been part of the German army after World War One, disbanded units and so forth. And they just became laws unto themselves, and the Rossbach organization was one of the more notable ones in terms of helping the and providing the foundation for the National Socialist Movement itself and later on the Nazi Party. But there, of course, was the other organization in Berlin led by Magnus Hirschfeld, an effeminate Jewish homosexual and a physician. He developed the Scientific Humanitarian Committee for the Emancipation of Homosexuals in Germany and repeal of Section 175 of the German Penal Code as applied to sexual crimes, and also he formed the Institute of Sexology, which in America became the Bloomfield, Indiana Institute of Sexology, or the Kinsey Institute, was basically mimicked primarily what was going on. Even Kinsey was actually more, he wasn't really, he wasn't a physician, he wasn't really didn't have the kinds of credentials that even Magnus Hirschfeld had, even though Magnus Hirschfeld was not really maybe engaged in true science as much as he was cataloging all these sexual anomalies and dealing the people who had been sentenced in the German court system. They were sent to Magnus Hirschfeld's institute for treatment and observation and so forth.
Well, now, but that was really discussing is 75 years ago, there was like a gay liberation movement in Germany, and this was actually instrumental, you know, in really bringing about the rise of Hitler. But there's nothing new under the sun. What's going on in America took place in Germany 75 years ago, but the same sort of things took place in ancient Greece. They took place in ancient Rome. There's nothing new about homosexuality, and trying to claim that it's normal, the only trouble is, it isn't.
Well, normality, I saw a psychoanalytical definition of the term what is normal, or the question of what is normal, how do we define normality. And of course, normality is that which functions in accordance with its design. And when the two males and two females are not complementary to one another, they're similar. They're not mutually affirmative genders, they're conflicting genders. So, and that's what basically the male-female relationship is all about. It's a complementary union of a male and a female in marriage of human sexuality. I mean, that's what marriage is all about. That's why gay marriage is such an oxymoron, a contradiction in terms, because two members of the same gender cannot, one cannot affirm the other, one cannot complete the other. Although there is something to be said for the fragmentation of psychosexual gender identity, where, and this is what Magnus Hirschfeld proposed, was is that the homosexual was actually representative of a third gender, otherwise like a female in a male's body, and this type of thing. So he wanted, he actually wanted to define this entirely separate gender of people known as homosexuals and so forth. But at first, Adolf Brandt's group, they didn't want to consider the homoerotic dysfunction, as I refer to it, as being explained by this idea of a woman in a man's body, because it sort of went against their whole concept of ubermenschen or supermale identity.
Now, of course, then there was a lot of antagonism between the effeminate homosexuals in Hitler's Germany and the very homosexuals, wasn't there?
Yes, there was, and as a matter of fact, the first book burning in Germany after the Nazis came to power was to destroy documentation of sexual crimes amongst the Nazi rank and file, and so they burnt Magnus Hirschfeld's library. They destroyed some 40,000 records. The gynecologist that had worked there at the time documents that and reports that, and we document that in the Pink Swastika, which, by the way, can be read online at my co-author's site, and it can be found through the www.slaveshipamerica.com or .net or .org. And basically there is a link at the bottom of the feature article that's up right now, La Amistad, Slave Ship America, which everybody should read, and go to the link at the bottom for the Pink Swastika, Homosexuality and the Nazi Party, which is the, and it's actually the fourth edition. We went through, we were up to the fourth edition now, which is twice the size of the, with, you know, better notations and more information, more documentation. This is not an opinion book. It's well documented and well researched, and it's well supported by academia, both academia and lay people alike.
And of course, this is known, certainly well known in Hitler in Germany today. It has certainly not been, though, highly popularized here in the United States, other than through your efforts and Scott Lively's efforts, you know, to let the American people understand that what we're seeing today is sort of like deja vu all over again, that the homosexuals played a very important part in the politics of Hitler's Germany, certainly bringing him into power, and then of course what happened? Now, Hitler gets into power, there's a crisis situation, the economy is collapsing, inflation's out of control, Hindenburg was a sitter, had won 40% of the votes, and so he prevails upon Hindenburg to declare a state of emergency, and Hindenburg is totally incapable of leading, and he then makes Adolf Hitler, the Germany, assuming Hindenburg's power. So pick up the story from there.
Hitler was a master politician. Don't ever think that the Nazis were like Hogan's heroes. They were not. They were very proficient. They were very intelligent. They were very capable at what they did. Hitler was a master politician. He played one side against the other. He practiced divide and rule, divide and conquer strategies. He used the mechanisms of democracy to bring about totalitarian or authoritarian dictatorship, and he understood that he couldn't confront the democracy. He understood that he couldn't confront the democratic Weimar Republic, or the Weimar Republic directly. And he tried it once in the early part, in the original Beer Hall Putsch, and it was unsuccessful. He ended up in Landsberg prison in 1926. It wasn't until a few years later that he was released and he was picked up where he left off. And that's when he called Rome back to reorganize the SA, the Brown Shirt Organization. And when Rome finally took charge, the Brown Shirts ended up being some 4.5 million men strong.
This is a volunteer organization, and yet, of course, they run roughshod over the democratic process. They beat up anybody. They terrorized anybody who dared stand against them. Wouldn't that be?
Exactly. They worked from the ground up, and the political party worked from the top down.
Right.
That was the strategy. So basically, Rome was actually the kingmaker. Rome was the kingmaker. Rome was homosexualist faction in Germany was the faction that was behind Hitler and brought Hitler into power. And of course, there is documentation now, a very strong documentation that points to Hitler as being himself a militant gay pederast, or at least a member of that particular crowd.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Kevin Abrams talking more about the book, The Pink Swastika. It's fascinating. You need to understand the history. For those who don't understand, the past are condemned to repeat it. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Kevin Abrams. We're talking about the book, The Pink Swastika. And so now we have Ernst Röhm, who leads this homosexual organization. Was everybody in the brown shirts a homosexual, or were they simply a significant number of homosexuals there?
To be in a leadership position from roughly above the level of sergeant, you had to be a homosexualist. You had to be a member of the... You had to be in the confidence of Röhm. And in Rome's confidence.
Well, now, what was happening to the female or the effeminate the homosexuals at this time?
Up until 1933, of course, they were in a competitive. They were very much competing for the prominent becoming the prominent movement in Germany. And actually, in 1934, after the Rome Purge, July 1st, the initial night of the Rome Purge, there were many SS officer by Rome loyalists. And there was a note left on their tunic called Rocker's Avengers or Rome's Avengers. Now, when the Brown Shirts were labeled a criminal organization by the Nazi Party, and so many Brown Shirts were arrested. And of course, the final figure of the killing that went on the night of the Bob Purge or the Night of the Long Knives is in some dispute because to decide which one was relative to the purge and which one was relative to settling personal grudges and so forth, because a lot of killing went on that wasn't really related to the purge itself, but was the settling of personal grudges. Hitler had a personal grudge against a few people, and etc. But it was basically that night was a consolidation of power, because Hitler was threatened with removal by Hermann Göring and the Krupp industrialist faction, and we don't want any further social revolution. We don't want this second revolution that Rome is talking about. We don't want him to take over or eclipse the German army and use it as a training corps for the Brown Shirt organization. And so they felt very threatened by the Rome faction and said, to get rid of Rome or we're going to get rid of you. It was a very difficult decision for Hitler to make, because Rome was like his father. It was like a father figure, like a mentor figure to him. And he knew that Rome was the person that really made him. And Rome was actually his equal, more than his equal. So Hitler really took a very drastic measure to consolidate his power with the German military and the industrialists and the landowners themselves. So they fell in line behind Hitler because they saw that Hitler was willing to act. And in time of Germany's greatest need, of course, Hindenburg sent him a letter of congratulations and thanks for having taken this initiative. And purged the SA and so forth and brought order to Germany, because that's what the German people were calling for. And they portrayed it in the German media as a moral cleansing, where in fact it was just basically a consolidation of.
So many people in Germany thought it was perfectly all right to kill all the homosexuals because this was going to bring order back to society. Would that be a fair statement?
They were tired of the antics of Rome, because they used to have these homosexual orgies at the Brown House and the German people were pretty tired of what was going on with the Brown Shirt organization, the intimidation and the unruliness and the embarrassment that Ernst Röhm and his clique of fellow homosexualists constituted to the German
people. Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Stephen Kevin Abrams. We're talking about the book that he co-authored with Scott Lively called The Pink Swastika, and it really deals with the homosexual Germany, which was very powerful, which was in Hitler to power, and of course the man who headed the Brown Shirts, which was predominantly, at least the leadership, was all homosexual, the masculine form of homosexual. Of course, the man who led this was Ernst Röhm, who was a very close personal friend, almost a mentor to Adolf Hitler, and yet, because there was unrest in the country, because of the vulgarity and certainly the blatant immorality of the homosexuals, why there was tremendous pressure put on to Adolf Hitler to eliminate Rome and to eliminate the Brown Shirts as a paramilitary organization. They had about 4.5 million people, and so came the Night of the Long Knives. Do you remember when that was? Have any idea, Kevin?
June 30th, July 1st, 1934.
So just about a year after Adolf Hitler had come to power. And who actually did the murdering? Was this the military? Who coordinated attack on the Brown Shirts?
Members of Hitler's bodyguard, okay. SS, the special.
Okay. This was the SS, and of course, yes. then they were sort of an elite. Almost like the special forces here in the United States. They were totally dedicated to their leaders and they were trained killers. They'd do whatever they were told to do, wouldn't they?
Yes, well, they swore allegiance to Hitler.
Right.
They didn't swear allegiance to Germany. They were specifically sworn to protect Hitler.
And of course, they were looked upon almost like the Teutonic Knights, and they had the skull and crossbones on their helmets, or on their hats. They, of course, wore brown uniforms. They all each had a ring that's supposed to spiritual significance. In fact, there was almost an occult significance to this whole SS movement, wasn't there?
Yes, well, actually, it's no accident that Himmler was known as the Black Jesuit, because he organized the SS around Jesuit... Uh, the Jesuit organization. And it was very occultic. They had a castle that where they used to have ceremonies and so forth. And the study, it's worth a study in itself, but they were very religious. Actually, the Nazis, they say that the Nazis were against religion. They weren't really against religion. It was just that they were against the ethical monotheistic paradigm in preference for a more occultic and New Age type paradigm where there was a master class and then the working class, and then the people that were eliminated, and you know, there was the party, and so forth. It was the occultic core, the Vril society, the Thule society, the Armenian order, all these groups, all these secret organizations, these secret occultic groups, or racial aerial sophist groups, and so forth, were really what were driving they were the quickening proletarian and political actions they were the core, they were the end behind what was really happening overtly.
And I think for anybody who really wants to understand the Nazi movement, you need to see the History Channel put it out. I think it's called The Occult in the Third Reich. It's 4 hours of programs, excellent programs, giving the whole background of the occult foundation, not only of Hitler, but of his followers, and specifically the SS and Heinrich Himmler. So I think it's important to understand that aspect. But then they were the ones who carried out the murder of the Brown Church. Do we have any idea how many people that died that night of the night of the long knives? I mean, are we talking about hundreds, thousands?
I've seen figures anywhere from 150 to 1,500, but depending upon, you know, how you classify them, people who were just immediately taken out and shot, the leadership, the those most loyal to Rom, those who couldn't be reformed, so to speak, and the Brown Troopers were at that point disbanded. They were the Stormtrooper and the Brown Troopers were totally disbanded, and everybody had to reapply or be rescreened for entry into other units and retrained and so forth, because the Brown Troopers were basically street fighters. They weren't they weren't really a trained military, and it was just basically a big gang.
All right, fine. And so this is the part of the Hitler's story of the story of the Third Reich most people don't understand. And of course, it was the strong homosexual influence within the Brown Shirts that brought Hitler to power. Now he had power, he knew homosexuals, who were simply had been the cadre that had brought him to power, and now, of course, they became the expendable. And of course, because anybody who opposed Hitler ended up going to a concentration camp, certainly many of the effeminate were taken off to concentration camps, and they wore, of course, a pink triangle. Well, we'll get into that. And of course, the Brown Shirts wore a brown triangle. Those who went to prison will be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Kevin Abrams. We're talking about the book, The Pink Swastika. Now, why were the effeminate homosexuals arrested?
Well, you know, it's not clear as to why many of them were arrested. Some of them were not homosexuals at all. They were simply political, labeled to be political enemies of the Nazi movement. And so the Gestapo trumped up some charges of homosexuality and so forth, and then they were arrested and incarcerated, and they were eliminated that way. Even the head of the German army, General Werner von Fritsch, was libeled with false accusations of having had a homosexual relationship, and later exonerated. But he nevertheless was removed, and of course Keitel was placed, who was referred to as Hitler's lapdog. Was replaced General von Fritsch as head of the German army. So many people were not actually who were arrested were not homosexual at all. As I say, it was just a Gestapo frame up. And those that were, of course, as I mentioned before, the Nazis had little use for the brand of feminine side or the female side of the homoerotic community or the homosexual. So they look down upon them as being weak and enfeebled and an element to be repressed in a racially superior organization or nation. So that's why they were looked down upon and why they're, but they weren't really targeted for persecution. As a matter of fact, the cousin of Hermann Göring had an institute for dealing with homosexuals. They tried to read homosexual impulse. They compelled homosexuals to sleep with prostitutes, thinking that that would do it. But a gender weakened male is terribly frightened of the female sexual persona, so it didn't really work that well. And they just tried all sorts of different strategies to repair the homosexual impulse or the homoerotic impulse, and many of them, most of them, didn't really work that well because they didn't really understand it that well. Anyways, they weren't persecuted. They weren't targeted for persecution as the Jewish people were. The Jewish people were targeted specifically for elimination by German racial eugenics law. Whereas, you know, when the Nazis came to power, there were over 3.5 million homosexuals registered in German organizations as homosexuals and gays and so forth. The German Nazis were
right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest. We're talking about the German homosexual movement, and he was saying that there were 3 or 4 million registered homosexuals, at the time of Hitler's taken over. Why they registered them, I really don't know. And they tried, of course, with the female homosexuals, to try to take them into training, to try to overcome their urges, their homoerotic urges, and none of the treatments that were tried, and we're talking about, 75 years or so ago, none of the treatment really tended to work. So pick up the story from there.
Yeah, the treatment, the Hermann Göring Institute was where a lot of this treatment took place. But of course, if you were Jewish and a homosexual, that was a different matter. You weren't really persecuted because you were a homosexualist. You were persecuted because you were Jewish. And, basically the Germans really didn't, or the Nazi movement really didn't, there were some 12,000 Pink Triangle arrests. And like I mentioned before, there were 5,000 who perished in concentration or prison camps.
Well, why were they arrested, though? Were they arrested because they were political opponents or because they were homosexual?
Variety of different reasons. Could have been that they were homosexuals and maybe... You see, there were a lot of... homosexuals used to... there was a lot of blackmail that went on, too. People were framed up. They were caught in a relationship that would compromise them politically or with their family, and then they were blackmailed. There was a lot of underground, undercurrent stuff that was going on. Germany at that time. Actually, Hitler referred to Berlin as the Whore of Babylon. He sort of perceived it himself that Germany was fairly corrupt. And it was known internationally that if anybody really wanted anything to do with any form of corrupt sexual activity or whatever, that Germany was like an open, was open season. And you could find it there. There were confusing times. There's a book out, Between the Flames, that is written about that era, and it talks about how mothers used to sell their daughters into prostitution and so forth. The Pink Swastika stipulates that if you lose your two pillars of human civilization, then you've lost your civilization. Even though you might be a powerful technocratic or scientific state, you still haven't got the two pillars that represent you or that make you a civilized society, which is honest weights and measures in the marketplace. Their currency had been debased, the economy had been totally corrupted, and a moral and healthy sexual constitution. And of course, Germany had lost that between the flames, between World War One. It had trouble with that for some time before that. And of course, the original psychoanalytical society, Dr. Freud, was founded in Vienna, and he tried to explore this whole idea of homosexuality and this whole Oedipus penis envy and this sort of thing, and this is what he originally this is but he really didn't develop. He was a pioneer, and he came up with some basic ideas about what was involved. But later on, people like Dr. Joseph Nicolosi, who was conducting clinical research in California, and Dr. Charles Pacharides, another American pioneer relative to questions of the causal factors behind homoerotic impulse. There's some people, but NARTH organization actually has a website that your listeners might be interested in. It's www.narth.com, and you'll find a lot of very valuable information. Insights are available to you and your listeners on that website pertaining to the various aspects of homosexuality.
Why don't you, of course, get your website out in case anybody would like to get in touch with you or Scott?
Well, of course, Scott Lively has got his own website, and that's the website that the Pink Swastika is on, and they can contact Scott through that website, Abiding Truth Ministries. And also, the website that I have up is slaveshipamerica.com.net.org, and you can contact me through that website. It's on the link, Contact Us. And just contact the webmaster, and that'll get through to me.
All right, well, let's go to Ray, who's calling us from Santa Cruz. Hi, Ray. Did you have a question?
Hello again. Yeah, you guessed. I'm surprised you didn't mention Reinhard Heydrich. And I'd be interested to know further what kind of relationship him and Himmler had. I mean, did he have power over Himmler, or did Himmler have power over him?
They were competitors. They competed for the attentions of the Führer. But Heinrich Heydrich was designated as second. He was going to be the heir apparent to Hitler if anything had happened to Hitler. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, you know, Heydrich had a Jewish grandparent.
Yeah, I heard about that, yeah.
And under German racial laws, he should have never been in the position
I
that he
was in.
I heard
about that, yeah.
But because he was useful to the Nazi movement, and he was a rabid anti-Semite. You see, not all people who have Jewish roots or Jewish blood or are born really in tune with the Jewish ethos. In fact, many of our worst enemies have come from within the Jewish fold itself.
Mm-hmm. In fact, one of them was Karl Marx. He really was violently anti-Semitic. Doesn't make any sense, but then we live in a world gone mad. Anything else, Ray?
I wanted to mention that Himmler believed in reincarnation, and he believed that he was the reincarnation of Heinrich the First, I think it was.
Fred.
There was strong cult influences all throughout every aspect of the Nazi movement, and this is, of course, what people do not recognize, nor do they see the dangers as the occult influence comes into every aspect of our society.
I think that we've got some of them. I think we've got some Nazis up in our government in D.C.
Well, you just have to look at the Skull and Bones.
The Skull and Bones
has direct linkage to the Nazi movement. And their practices are very much.
And everybody, of course, there have been people who have actually gotten into the tomb, their headquarters there at Yale University.
In
the book called The Secrets of the Tomb, they describe all the Nazi memorabilia on the walls there. Why would, these people have Nazi memorabilia? And does it bother you that during the last presidential election, both political candidates, the Democrat and the Republican, came from that very same secret society that has the Nazi memorabilia on the walls of their tomb?
But I think the Nazis tapped into something. It was very primal, you know, the whole symbolism, you know, the whole thing was very ultra masculine type of ideal, you know.
It was primal. It was primal.
But of course, the swastika, Ray, was a mystic symbol long after dating that, in fact, this was something that you'll find that Madame Blavatsky used that, certainly the great...
The Babylonians used it,
right,
I think.
It's been around for a long time. Yeah. It's a symbol of the sun god.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks so much for calling.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, and of course, go right ahead there.
Yes, so what we're really learning here is that the Nazis were very religious, but they were religious in an antithetical way to the mores of Western civilization, and certainly to the ethical and moral covenant between the Jewish people and God. Entered into at Mount Sinai 3,400 years ago, which is still in effect today. and basically as the Jewish people are the witnesses to the to this covenant, which calls for certain standards ethically and morally in terms of our interactions with one another, and especially sexual morality and honest weights and measures. This is what the Jewish ethos. These are two of the primary pillars of human dignity, of human civilization, and of course the Nazis represented. They were thieves. They plundered European art treasures, and they while accusing the Jews of being of conspiring to rule the world and so forth, they themselves had embarked on an agenda to invade and plunder and murder their neighbors. So the speck, they didn't really talk about the speck in their own eye, but in truth, their agenda, their politics, their whole ideology was represented the nemesis of ethical monotheism as it is laid out in the Torah and as it has been witnessed to by the Jewish people throughout the centuries, and we're basically the keepers of the gate. What's the first thing that a murderer wants to do if someone has seen his crime? He wants to eliminate the witness. And so that's why, you know, when we have a situation in the United States where we have a crime, a murder, often there have been in the past witness protection programs, because the witnesses are the ones who are targeted quite frequently by criminals. And so we try and protect them from until the due process has been allowed to take place in the justice system. But unfortunately, what we have in the United States and Canada today is more of an administrative system rather than a justice system. And, you know, constitutional law has been undermined by the science, or by the science of Alfred Kinsey, who was actually a sex criminal more than anything else. And he engaged in criminal sexual activity under the guise of practicing science, and he was portrayed as being a legitimate scientist by the Rockefeller Media Organization, people like Hugh Hefner and so forth. And what happened was that science, specifically sexology, became the measuring or the measure of what the American Bar Association, the American Legal Association, would promote in terms of law in reference to sex crimes. And this whole very well documented by Dr. Judith Reisman in her book Kinsey, Crimes and Consequences, The Red Queen and the Grand Scheme, which is all about Alfred Kinsey.
All right, fine. Of course, we Radio Liberty, as well as we carry the book this week, Pink Swastika, because we think both of these books are very important for your understanding of what's going on. And of course, as Judith Reisman makes so very clear in her book, why the whole purpose of Kinsey was to use fraudulent science to justify changing the United States in relationship to pedophilia, in relationship to homosexuality, in relationship to sexual immorality. Kinsey was intent upon changing the moral fabric of our society. But the most carefully kept secret is, of course, that this was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, and the last thing they want is for the American people to find out that the Rockefeller Foundation has been involved not only with funding Kinsey, but in this whole effort to destroy the moral fabric of our society. Well, we've got Daryl, who's calling from Pennsylvania. Hi, Daryl. How are you doing? It's late back there, isn't it?
Yes, sir. It's a 12:45.
Right.
But I enjoy listening to your program. You always have interesting guests, and I do have the book, The Pink Swastika, and I would urge everyone to get that book. I was glad to hear your guest mention that Himmler modeled the SS on the Jesuit order, and I agree with both of you that the Rome and the Brown Shirts played or were a major player in bringing Hitler to power, but there was also another major player that hasn't been mentioned, and that was the Catholic Centrum Party in Bavaria under and another man named, he was a Knight of Malta, named Franz von Papen, who was a major player in helping bring Hitler to power. And amazingly, Franz von Papen walked. He was acquitted of all charges at the Nuremberg trials. Does your guest know anything about that, or would like to add anything about that?
Well, I have some differences with in terms of how Eric John Phelps feels about race issues and so forth. But I think that the best documentation I've ever seen put forth in reference to the Vatican and Romanism is on the site www.vaticanassassins.org. And that is a site that is maintained by Eric Johann Phelps, a Calvinist Freeman, a Protestant Christian. And basically what he states, of course, is that the Constitution of the United States is a Calvinist document. And what the original colonists were fleeing from in Europe to a certain extent was religious religious authoritarianism, and the repression that a state-sanctioned religion represented to them. So that was what the freedom of religion, actually, or freedom from religion, or whatever, however you want to refer to it, really meant in the original colonies of the United States, is that no religion should form a bond with the state and ride roughshod over other religious denominations. But in no way did the Founding Fathers infer that morals and ethics should be abandoned because of this tolerance for the various religious denominations. To the contrary, the American colonists, the original Founding Fathers, were very providential in their sense of succeeding against the British and against European powers, and they were very very cognizant of God's presence and morality, is that this new world was a moral and ethical experiment, and that actually would set a new precedent, a new course for humanity, and that was their thinking.
Right, and I have one final question for the guest, and that is, Himmler's uncle was a Jesuit priest and a very high office. Did he really run the SS, or did Heinrich Himmler run it?
You know, that's a good question. It's one I haven't been asked, but I suspect that, you know, Heinrich Himmler is referred to as a doppelganger, as a mirror image of the Führer. And I suppose, like, for instance, Karl Haushofer was a too.
Did you know that?
Haushofer.
We're just about out of time, Darryl, but thanks so much for calling.
And God bless you, gentlemen. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead. What are we going to say there about Haushofer? Because Haushofer is really one of the key figures. He was one of the spiritual forces, was a spiritual force that energized the movement. So where does Haushofer fit into this?
Well, he was strongly involved in the occult, and the Brill Society was very occultic and very much... His thinking was really sort of... He was actually one of Hitler's mentors. He was involved with... actually, Rudolf Hess, more so. He was more directly involved with Rudolf Hess, who became Hitler's secretary. And there's some suggestion that Karl Haushofer is actually the one who guided Hitler in the writing of Mein Kampf. The effect that... like, for instance, Dietrich Eckart, Hitler considered him to be his mentor. And Dietrich Eckart also said that Hitler would be dancing to his tune. And actually, in Mein Kampf, Hitler dedicates, I believe, a chapter at least to his mentor, Dietrich Eckart, who was a member of the Thule Society and then introduced Hitler into the fold, sort of thing, into occultic circles. So, and he also unlocked Hitler's psychic powers. He facilitated the unlocking of Hitler's psychic powers, which were considerable. Hitler was capable of penetrating to the inner person, and that's why he always looked directly at the individual. People felt like they couldn't hide very much from Hitler, that he was such a penetrating type of individual.
Well, I think that really Hitler had supernatural ability. I think he was able to control those crowds. The crowds would stand there for 4 or 5 hours as he harangued and spoke. He really forced of his will to force other Germans to do things that no sane person ever would have done, and to follow him as he led Hitler led Germany towards its destruction. We'll be back here in just a moment to wrap up the program here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We have Kevin Abrams with us. And Kevin, would you like to go ahead? We've got 3 minutes before I have to let you go.
Well, I appreciate the time that we've spent together on the show. And I appreciate your callers. And I think that there's some serious questions that need to be asked about the future of Western civilization. I think that I would encourage people to read, gird your loins with strength, sort of thing. And don't be... it's time to put away the golf clubs and to not pursue entertainment to such a high degree as most people do in Western civilization, and to clear your head and then to begin to penetrate into some of the things that are really going on, some of the things that are behind what's happening in the world today, and to come to a deeper understanding and a deeper perception in line with the human capacity to do so. I think that it's important that you go to our website, Slave Ship America, or my website, slaveshipamerica.com.org.net, read Judith Rees, and do some research. But, you know, Voltaire said, history never repeats itself, man always does. And man does because he goes through this cyclical process of forgetting what happened and saying, well, it's not my problem, and, you know, it's the neighbor's problem, as long as it just sits in the neighbor's yard. But believe me, each and every one of us has a basic responsibility, and that's to uplift and guard the dignity and freedom of our fellow man. And when we do that for one another, we'll all live in freedom, and we'll all live in security and dignity.
And I agree with you totally. I think it's so important people understand the forces that were at work in Hitler's Germany, and of course the homosexual influence within that society, and then of course as the Nazis moved against the homosexuals, and certainly many homosexuals were in key positions in the Nazi movement and stayed there, you know, but it was the effeminate homosexuals, of course, who felt the brunt of the wrath. Would that be a fair statement, Kevin?
Yes, you know, homosexual is a false identity, just like gay marriage is an oxymoron. It is a political or a psychosexual, it's a false identity, it's labeling. It's like saying you're a smoker that must smoke, or you're a homosexual with homoerotic conduct. There's a semantic component to the whole issue. So we must become bigger than our labels. Otherwise, we're not lawyers, we're not doctors, we're human beings with unlimited capacities for insight and understanding, and in terms of we have this broad spectrum of potential that we don't recognize when we reduce ourselves to labels.
I agree with you totally, Kevin. Thank you so very much. It's been a real pleasure having you here as a guest, not once but several times on Radio Liberty, and our guest has been Kevin Abrams. Good night. God bless you.
Thank you so much.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I think that this is an important part of history that is never mentioned. And, of course, to me, the most significant part of this whole story is the occult influence within the Third Reich. And the occult influence you find so very, very prominently within the homosexual movement, not only in Hitler's Germany, but right here in America today. And, you know, you only need to read Judith Reisman's book, and she has there a picture of Alfred Kinsey, who himself was a homosexual, standing before a shrine of Aleister Crowley, and you'll actually see the shadow of a man who's hanging, being projected upon the wall, and this is, of course, where Aleister Crowley had lived, and where, of course, he was involved, and many people believed in child sacrifice. Aleister Crowley was a Satanist, and Alfred Kinsey was fascinated. If you look at our videos, which we have, they're called They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. It is pointed out that Aleister Crowley is one of the most influential men in America today, even though he's been dead since the 1940s. But Aleister Crowley had inspired the Beatles and so many of our music stars, Marilyn Manson and Ozzy Osbourne, and so many of the various very significant music groups here in America were all dedicated to Crowley. Crowley had actually inspired Timothy Leary, who led the drug revolution. Crowley had inspired Kinsey, who led the sexual revolution. Crowley had inspired a man named Harry Hay, who organized the gay liberation movement. All of this, of course, is the present-day manifestations of Crowley's teachings, and Crowley was a Satanist. He was a 33rd degree Mason for 12 years before he was invited to go into the upper echelons of Masonry, at levels at which most Masons don't even know exist. But this is where the Frank worship of Lucifer takes place, the great architect of the universe. Well, if you'd like, of course, to get the book Kinsey, Crime and Consequences by Judith Reisman, or if you'd like to know more about the book The Pink Swastika by Kevin Abrams and Scott Lively, or you'd like to know more about the videos They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, That's They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. Why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter. And that our main newsletter goes into the occult hierarchy that rules the world. That's the occult hierarchy that rules the world. I would be glad to send you a copy of our May newsletter, or, of course, if you can go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Why, you can get a copy of my May newsletter. Just pull it down. You have our permission to copy that and disseminate it. And then, of course, we have a new DVD, relatively new, called The Coming Financial Crisis, and it is available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you would like to get my newsletters on the monetary system, we will have those available probably by next. There are four newsletters we've written giving you the background not only of the monetary system we have, but of the spiritual forces which have energized this monetary system going back to going back to the time of our Lord, going back through the time of the ancient temple.